If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello, I'm Rob Attar, and this is the third History Extra podcast for September 2012. Coming up this week, we have...
I discovered that living in sin, the term, didn't actually mean living together as a couple unmarried.
That was Rebecca Probert talking about cohabitation in the Victorian era.
Just as banks sought to manipulate LIBOR to their advantage today, we can find examples of merchants trying to manipulate exchange rates in the Middle Ages.
And that was Tony Moore on historical parallels to the recent LIBOR scandal. You're listening to the History Extra podcast, which is brought to you by the team behind BBC History magazine. You can find the magazine in all good newsagents and on subscription. Plus, we have a Kindle edition available on the Amazon website and an iPad edition on the Apple newsstand. You can find out more details of all of this, plus great subscription deals at our website, which is historyextra.com. If you have any comments about the podcast or any of our other products, you can get in touch with us through email, podcast@historyextra.com, on Twitter, twitter.com/historyextra, or Facebook, facebook.com/historyextra. The idea that Victorian working class couples chose to live together rather than marry is one that has been traditionally accepted in academic circles. But was this actually the case? The magazine's section editor, Charlotte Hodgman, caught up with Rebecca Probert, a professor at the University of Warwick Law School and author of a new book on the subject, to find out more.
So what's the traditional view of cohabitation in Victorian Britain, and why have people come to this conclusion?
Well, the assumption has always been that a significant number, particularly of the poor, were living together outside marriage. And we can actually trace this assumption right back to the Victorian period. We find Victorian clergymen fulminating about the poor living in sin, the journalist Henry Mayhew claiming that 9/10 of costermongers were unmarried, and even the social investigator Charles Booth commenting on the number who gave the same address when they got married. And then added to this, when modern historians started to do parish reconstructions, looking at whether they could trace baptisms, marriages, burials, they found there was always a significant minority for whom they couldn't trace a marriage. And they basically assumed that these couples must have been cohabiting, which led them to come up with quite high estimates of cohabitation in the region of sort of 20% of the population. So at first sight, there did seem to be good evidence that cohabitation was pretty common in Victorian England. And this was actually my starting assumption when I began to look at this area.
And so what evidence have you found to the contrary?
Well, the evidence that I've uncovered actually undermines all the claims that have been made. And the reason why I've come up with such different findings is because I've tested every single claim by going back to primary sources rather than simply relying on the secondary sources or the actual claims. Now, first of all, there's the matter of misleading language. I discovered that living in sin, the term, didn't actually mean living together as a couple unmarried in this period. So all these claims about the multitudes living in sin suddenly had to be re-evaluated. Now, Victorian commentators regarded a whole range of activities as sinful. You know, not believing in God, smoking, eating too much. And when they referred to living in sin, they usually meant the general sinfulness of mankind rather than the specific sin of cohabiting outside marriage. So I discovered this by tracking the use of the phrase through 19th and 20th century newspapers. It's only in the 20th century that it begins to mean cohabitation exclusively.
And what areas have you concentrated on in particular?
Well, if I just sort of go on with unpicking some of the claims that have been made. There's Mayhew's claims about the costermongers, this idea that 9/10 of them were living outside marriage. Now, Mayhew was a journalist looking for good copy, and his methods have been regarded as somewhat dubious, paying for information, for example. He didn't go out and do a count of costermongers, and so he had absolutely no means of knowing how many were married and how many were not. But the really clinching piece of evidence for me was when I discovered quite by chance that the costermongers had actually held a public meeting specifically to refute the claims that Mayhew had meant about them. And I think I'd rather believe them than what a middle-class journalist was writing for a middle-class audience. And then we come on to Booth's suggestion that many couples who got married gave the same address. Now, this is true. If you look at marriage registers, it's really surprising how often the same address is recorded. But I checked whether they were actually living at that address. I took a sample of couples who'd married in the 2 or 3 months after the census was taken. And only a fraction of them who gave the same address were actually sharing a home. And at least half of those who were sharing a home, which is quite a small proportion anyway, they weren't cohabiting in the modern sense. You know, the prospective bride or groom was there as a boarder or lodger with the entire family. They weren't setting up as an independent unit in advance of the wedding. And then finally, there's the assumption of modern historians that failing to trace a marriage for a couple can be taken as evidence that they were cohabiting. Now, as anyone who's been tracing their family tree will be able to tell you, there's many reasons why it might not be possible to trace a marriage. And these historians were working at a time when tracing a marriage was a matter of going to the local record office and working through parish registers. Now, there's a limit to the number of parish registers that you can look at in a lifetime. So they tended only to look at the parish of origin, the parties. You know, where the husband, wife were born and where the eldest child was born. Now, I use this methodology for one sample and traced marriages for only 67% of couples, which was actually even lower than what these earlier historians had managed. I then repeated the exercise using modern digital databases and managed to trace marriages for every single couple, the whole 100%. So the extent of cohabitation has been exaggerated because it's only quite recently that it's even become possible to search for marriages over a wider area. So just to sum up, it's not simply a matter of there being new evidence to weigh in the balance against these earlier claims. This research actually undermines the fundamental assumptions that underpinned these earlier claims.
So why would many couples have chosen to marry rather than to cohabit?
I mean, it's even asking that question, it's a really modern way of putting it, because today we ask why couples marry, but in the 19th century, marriage was so overwhelmingly the norm that most couples, if you were going to live with somebody, to have a relationship with them, they didn't think, shall we get married? I mean, it's almost like asking people why they get dressed before they leave the house. It's just taken as something that you do.
So to turn that on its head then, why would someone have chosen to cohabit rather than to have actually got married?
There's really quite few examples of couples choosing to cohabit. The main examples that we know about are ones who were in love, who wanted to live with the other person, but couldn't get married because one of them was already married to somebody else. And the classic example here is, of course, George Eliot, who lived for many years with the fellow writer George Henry Lewes, but didn't have the option of marrying him because he was already married and divorce was simply not a possibility for a whole range of complex reasons. It's actually quite interesting, though, that a lot of couples prefer to marry bigamously rather than cohabit without any ceremony. And a lot of historians tend to lump bigamous unions and other void marriages in with cohabiting couples because in the eyes of the law, they're all just cohabiting. But there's a really interesting question. If cohabitation is acceptable, why would you risk the penalty for bigamy? We can see if we look at statistics on bigamy, it's much more common in the Victorian period than it is today, for example. It's not just the greater availability of the divorce, it's also the much greater acceptability of cohabitation. It's only really right at the end of the 19th century that we find some couples genuinely choosing to cohabit for ideological reasons, perhaps inspired by novels such as Grant Allen's The Woman Who Did and Hardy's Jude the Obscure. Although they're both so depressing, I can't imagine actually many wanting to emulate them. And the classic example here is that of, two classic examples, Eleanor Marks and Edward Aveling, whose story didn't really have a very happy ending either, because Edward secretly married somebody else, and when Eleanor found out, she committed suicide. And then more positively, you have James Sullivan and Elsie Lanchester, the parents of Elsa Lanchester, the 20th century actress, who are both bohemian socialists and decided that they were going to live together and not get married. But that's really only right at the end of the period and very small and specific groups of people.
And how were cohabiting couples have been viewed and any children that they have within that relationship?
Well, the children, of course, are illegitimate with all the consequences that has. Cohabiting couples, at an institutional level at least, they're viewed very, very negatively. I mean, if you read reports of debates in Parliament, it's a common ploy for MPs opposing a particular law to claim that cohabitation is going to increase as a result of it, and that can be in things as apparently unrelated as employment law. Cohabitants, of course, had no legal rights. They didn't get any protection from the law because they were living together. The only thing that worked in their favour was that English law in this period was quite technical in its approach, and it didn't like disentitling people on the basis of their moral status. So if one cohabitant made a will in favour of the other, for example, then the fact that they were cohabiting didn't affect their rights under that will, but they basically had to take positive steps to confer any kind of legal rights on each other.
Were cohabiting couples more common in the lower classes, or was there no sort of class divide in this at all?
It's really, really difficult to tell because you're talking about such small numbers. We know about the high-profile ones. You know, there's always a sort of cluster of writers and artists who lived in cohabiting relationships, either because one was already married or because they subscribed to a more bohemian way of life. The assumption, as I said at the start, has been that cohabitation was common among the poor, but that doesn't seem to hold true from the evidence. But when you're talking about a fraction of 1% cohabiting, you know, a couple of individuals in any sample might skew your figures totally. And the same is true if you're trying to work out whether cohabitation levels are rising or falling in the in the Victorian period, or whether it's more common in the 18th century or the 20th century. Basically, throughout the 18th century, throughout the 19th century, it is a tiny proportion. It's only in the 20th century that it starts to grow, and only really in the 1960s that it becomes statistically significant and you can start doing proper analysis of trends.
And I mean, your research forms part of a wider project.
Yes.
Have you found any evidence of cohabitation in other periods? Is the Victorian era any different?
The Victorian period doesn't really stand out. When I came to it, I'd already looked at the 18th century and the early 20th century. So I was prepared to find a different picture in the Victorian period based on all this evidence that I outlined at the start. What I found was that there didn't seem to be any significant increase in cohabitation during the Victorian period. It is pretty low and pretty flat all the way through the 18th century, 19th century and start of the 20th century.
And was there such a thing as common law marriage during the Victorian period as the sort that we know today?
Well, there wasn't such a thing as common law marriage then. There never had been, and there isn't now either. There's this really popular idea that English law did once recognise common law marriage and that this was abolished by Lord Hardwicke's Act in 1753. This is actually a myth based on a misunderstanding of 18th century marriage law. And there's an even wider myth that there is such a thing as common law marriage today, whereby couples who live together for a certain period are entitled to the same rights as if they were married. Now, couples who live together get some rights, but certainly not the same package that they would get if they had married. And it's only in the late 1970s that we see that myth emerging, that that's the case.
Do you think that would have made many people want to marry? Is that part of it, do you think? Or was it purely like a religious and, like you say, something that was just natural?
It all forms part of the background. I don't think people consciously think, I have to get married for the legal rights. But the common law marriage myth does seem to change the terms on which people operate. Because you're not thinking consciously, I have to marry for these rights, but you're thinking, well, it's all the same now. It doesn't matter whether I get married or whether I live together. And it's in the wake of the common law marriage myth emerging that you see a really significant increase, not only in cohabitation, but also in couples living together and having children, because they feel confident to do so. They feel that they're going to have some protection if they do so. And it is all a myth.
And have you found any evidence to suggest that those who were found to be cohabiting in the Victorian period were maybe forced to marry, either by the church or by family?
There's certainly encouragement to marry. One of the reasons why, just going back to Charles Booth's survey about couples giving the same address when they married, one of the reasons, I think, why couples were giving the same address when they got married, even though they weren't living at the same address, is because Victorian vicars might waive the fees if they thought a couple were cohabiting. So if you pretended to be living together, this was a way of doing it for free. You don't tend to have marriages being forced by the parish in the 19th century, which you do find in the 18th century. If the woman gets pregnant and the parish then says to the man, right, you know, you're going to marry this woman. You don't find that in the 19th century to the same extent. But there is a lot of social pressure. And one of the couples I mentioned, James Sullivan and Edith Lanchester, the family, I think, did try to have her locked up to stop her cohabiting with James. But it was held that the law didn't have the power to do that.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
That was Rebecca Probert of the University of Warwick. Her book, The Changing Legal Regulation of Cohabitation, 1600 to 2010, From Fornicators to Family, has recently been published by Cambridge University Press. And you can read Rebecca's feature on the subject in our October issue, which also contains articles on Hitler's rise to power, Tudor explorations in America, and new trends in global history. It's available now in print, on Kindle, and on iPad. And now we have a short advert.
Have you been thinking about a change from your current role? Or have you just graduated and want to begin a career in history? You may find that your keen interests and existing knowledge are exactly what employers are searching for. The new job section on historyextra.com will provide you with a growing selection of available history-focused roles. Why not check it out and discover if your passion could become your career? Visit www.historyextra.com/jobs. You might just find what you're looking for.
Before our next interview, I thought I'd give you a quick heads up about our forthcoming First World War Day. On the 4th of November, we're hosting a day of talks by leading experts on the conflict at the Emshed Museum in Bristol. Speakers taking part include Gary Sheffield, Hugh Strawn, Mark Connolly, William Philpott and Peter Caddick Adams. Tickets for the whole day are just £40 for subscribers to the magazine and £50 for non-subscribers. To find out more and book tickets, please visit historyextra.com/events. Over recent weeks, it's been hard to escape news coverage of the LIBOR scandal, whereby several banks have been accused of manipulating interbank lending rates. But financial tricks like this are nothing new. Indeed, back in the medieval period, similar practices were taking place in order to circumvent usury laws. Tony Moore at the University of Reading is currently working on a project on 14th century finance, and so I caught up with him to examine some of those historical parallels. Now, the reason that we're talking to you today is because through your research you've uncovered some interesting parallels with what's happening today and the 14th century. Could you please tell us about that?
Yes, of course. What we're working on at the moment, I'm the research assistant on a new Leverhulme Trust funded project here at the University of Reading, which is examining the medieval foreign exchange market. So today the foreign exchange market is one of the biggest financial markets. It's estimated in there are probably around $250 billion, that's $1,000 trillion worth of foreign exchange transactions taking place each year, possibly more now. And in the Middle Ages, the FX market, the foreign exchange market, was another big driver of profits for banks. And what we're interested in is, or what we're looking at, is the idea that just as banks, to a certain extent, sought to manipulate LIBOR to their advantage today, we can find examples of merchants and people involved in the foreign exchange trade trying to manipulate exchange rates in the Middle Ages to increase their profits in the same way.
And am I right that there was something of a religious dimension to what was happening in those days?
Yes, and this gets us back to the comparison between financial engineering today and in the Middle Ages. The goal of financial engineering, much in the same way as normal engineering, is to get around an obstacle, is to resolve a problem. So while an engineer might see a river and think, how can we get from one side to the other, we'll build a bridge, a financial trader would see a restriction, a regulation, a way of stopping him from making money, and thinking, how can I get around this? And in the Middle Ages, the big restriction was the usury prohibition. It was the disapproval of charging interest on loans. The idea that this was unchristian, to charge your fellow, your brother in need, to try and make money from him because he needed to borrow.
So what the bankers or the financiers were trying to do in those days was essentially getting around this religious law. But how could they do that without being found out?
Yes. Well, I mean, we can go back and we can basically say that without some way of circumventing the prohibition on usury, there could have been no financial market, because who would lend money without getting something for it, unless you're a very charitable person? So there must, I mean, this is where we get to the idea that the circumvention of certain restrictions is not inherently wrong or evil or bad. Sometimes it's necessary in order for a market to function. So the merchants, the medieval merchants and financiers, are looking for ways of disguising interest within other transactions. The way that exchange rates could be manipulated to provide profits, to provide interest, is in fact what we're really interested in the current project. So the most sophisticated way that medieval bankers came up with to disguise the charging of interest, and in fact a method which dominated the international trade and financial markets from the Middle Ages until well into the early modern period, the 17th and 18th centuries, used what are called bills of exchange. Now, bills of exchange were foreign exchange instruments which were originally developed as a means of transferring money from one place to another for trading purposes, but they also involved a credit element. So to go into some detail here, the bill of exchange itself simply stated that the seller of the bill had received a sum of money in the local currency from the buyer of the bill in place A, and he was to repay this money in another place in the currency that was current there at a set exchange rate. Now, because, of course, medieval communications were much slower than we have today, there was always a time lag, a gap, quite substantial, between the buying and selling of a bill of exchange and its settlement, between person A receiving the money and then repaying person B in the second place. So there's a credit element. And obviously, the greater the distance between the two places, the longer the time lag, which was known as the usance period. So in effect, what we have is the seller of a bill of exchange was effectively borrowing money, and the buyer of a bill of exchange was lending it. But in order for this to function as a proper credit instrument, there needs to be some way to compensate the lender, in this case the buyer, for the time value of their money, basically to pay interest. And they achieved this by manipulating the exchange rates at places A and B. And it might make it clearer if we sort of go through an example. So this is an example taken from a document in the State Archives of Venice. So in Venice, on the 26th of September, 1442, Francesco Venieri and his company sold a bill of exchange for 150 ducats to Cosimo de' Medici, the famous Medicis, which was to be payable. So they were to they received 150 ducats in Venice, and they were to repay the Medici in London in 3 months' time at the rate of 44.5 pence sterling for every ducat. So Medici then sent the bill of exchange to his representatives in London, who were to present it to Venier's representatives and then to receive the sum due in sterling, which would have come to, as I'm sure you've already worked out, 6,675 pence, which is in old money just under £30. Now, the way that they actually get around the way they charge the interest is to change the exchange rate in London. So when Medici's representatives present the bill on the 31st of December, Venier's representatives, they don't pay it. They default. In the language, they protest the bill, and they send it back to Venier to be repaid in Venice. But this second exchange transaction takes place not at the original exchange rate of 44.5 pence sterling, but at the rate prevailing in London, which was in fact 41 and a quarter pence. So, and again, if we use our mental arithmetic, when the bill arrives back in Venice, Venier doesn't have to pay the 150 ducats he borrowed. He now has to pay just under 162 ducats. So if we trace the transactions, in effect, what has happened behind all these complicated bills going back and forth across Europe is that Venier has borrowed 150 ducats for 6 months, and he's paid 12 ducats in interest, which works out at an annualised interest rate of 15.7%.
So that's really fascinating. So there was a really sort of elaborate way of getting around the rules there. Mm. Did any of the secular or religious authorities know this kind of thing was going on? And if so, did they object to it?
There's an interesting question there, because obviously everyone knew this was going on. And some of the more religiously devout members of the church would complain about the practice. But in fact, very little was done in practice, because it was understood that without this means of paying interest, there would be no incentive for people to lend money or to fund international trade. So essentially, in practice, people turned a blind eye to it most of the time, because it was seen as necessary. Of course, at certain times, at times of great stress or pressure, politicians or the clergy might seek to focus public anger on lenders, or if particular people were considered to be charging an excessive rate of interest, they might be censured. But the basic principle that the lender of money deserved some form of a return was essentially accepted, at least tacitly, even if they couldn't fully endorse it under the strict reading of religious texts.
So you mentioned there that at times of stress, sometimes these financiers might become a bit unstuck. Would you say there's a parallel there between perhaps a modern banking crisis and the financial crisis, that finance is being scrutinised much more, and there's popular anger towards bankers who may have been doing similar things in the past and got away with it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there is no question. I don't think that the sorts of abuses that the bankers are being vilified for now were going on at least for the last decade. But while these these shady practices seemed to be producing a booming economy. The government didn't mind because tax revenues were up, so they could spend more money, improve services, and get re-elected. The people didn't mind because everyone had jobs. There was cheap credit they could use. They could get to buy new toys. House prices were going up, so everyone thought they were getting richer. So during the good times, essentially, people turned a blind eye to how the sausage was made, as it were. But of course, once everything went off the rails, then of course anger was directed towards these kinds of what we were now seeing as abuses.
So it's clear that in medieval period, because of the restrictive usury laws, there needed to be some financial engineering for a lot of economies to flourish. But what kind of negative side effects did that have?
One of the major costs of financial engineering and innovation is they tend to make systems more complex, more difficult to understand, more opaque. It's more difficult to see what is actually going on within the financial system. And that's a problem. It's a problem because it makes it more difficult for people to make informed decisions about what to do with their money, whether to borrow, how to fund purchases. And so while we may think that the usury prohibition is a great idea, that capping interest rates or banning interest altogether would in fact be progress. In fact, as we've seen in the Middle Ages, all that would happen is that people would find ways of disguising this. And in general, the advantage in this, in a more complicated system in which interest and charges are disguised and hidden, the advantage lies with the insider, lies with the people with better information who have a better idea of what's going on. So if you want to borrow money, it's generally better for you to borrow at an open rate, an open interest rate that everyone knows, rather than entering into a complicated transaction with all kinds of hidden charges and triggers that may seem cheaper on first glance, but in fact ends up being more expensive. And this is the issue with the usury prohibition in the medieval period and some of the attempts to regulate today, which is by pushing financial practices underground, by forcing people to come up with ever more ingenious ways of circumventing rules, you in fact make the system more difficult for people to understand, which is great for the people who run the system, because they are then able to make more money through these hidden charges, through manipulating the fact that other people don't understand the system as well as they do. But it's worse for people in general.
And I've read some things that you've written where you've mentioned that the peasants' revolt might have stemmed in part from some anger towards some of these financiers. Is that true?
In a sense, what's interesting with the peasants' revolt, it was not certainly just driven by anger towards financiers. There's important elements of the Hundred Years' War with France, which is going on at this period, which the English were usually accustomed to doing quite well in. In fact, the French had got the upper hand. So there was anger at the government for failing to sort of defend the nation. There was also anger at the people in government. We must remember that Edward III, the great hero, the greatest king of the Middle Ages, the paragon of chivalry, by the later 1370s, he's a very sick man, and he's not really in charge of government anymore. The people in charge of government are his son, John of Gaunt, a circle of financiers who were linked to, in fact, the king's mistress, Alice Perrers. So the suspicion is that it's these evil advisers behind the throne who are manipulating events. And essentially, one of the accusations is they're defrauding the crown. They're lending money to the king at outrageous rates of interest. They're claiming money for expenses, for military expenses that they then didn't actually pay. So they're personally profiting while the government seems to be failing. And then after Edward III's death, Richard II ascends the throne as a young child. So there's a minority government in which John of Gaunt is again the dominant figure. So there's this anger at a political system that seems to be failing and seems to be essentially giving out taxpayers' money to these bankers who are the friends and associates of the people in charge. And of course, there's also a wider social and economic element to this regarding the sort of imposition of unfree services on the population after the Black Death, which is a whole different story. The bit we're interested in at the moment is the sort of the political anger at the government and at the bankers who were intimately associated with that government.
And am I right that one or two of them even came to a sticky end during the Peasants' Revolt?
Yes, if we backtrack for a moment, and this again is where perhaps something, so an interesting parallel to today comes in. Initially, in 1376, there's a political crisis, what became known as the Good Parliament, where the Speaker of Parliament, Peter de la Mare, sort of stood up for the ordinary people of the community against this corrupt elite that seemed to be running government in their own interests. And people, members of this court faction, were prosecuted in Parliament, including Richard Lyons, who was possibly a Flemish immigrant who had risen to the top of London mercantile society and was accused of profiting in various ways from his closeness to Alice Perrers and other people at court. And initially, this great popular outcry in Parliament seems to have some effect. Alice Perrers is banished from court. Other courtiers are disgraced. Richard Lyons himself is supposed to be stripped of all his ill-gotten gains and consigned to prison at the Tower of London. But when we actually look a bit in a bit more detail, once Parliament has dissolved, once the immediate pressure, the immediate outcry and outrage has died down, what we see is that John of Gaunt, the government in government, quickly acts to bring his friends and associates back from the cold. Richard Lyons is soon out of prison. He's soon restored to all his properties. Perrers reappears back at court. So what we sort of have is the idea that Parliament, the political institutions, had failed to deal with these abuses and these outrages, which meant that when the sort of pent-up frustration exploded, it wasn't channeled through Parliament or the ordinary political institutions. It erupted in violence and mobs sort of ransacking the houses of these favourites, beheading some of them. Richard Lyons himself is dragged from his house and beheaded in the street. Simon of Sudbury, the Archbishop of Canterbury and Chancellor of England, so the chief civil servant, is dragged from the Tower where he'd been hiding and executed, as is the Treasurer. So, you know, perhaps George Osborne should be a bit more careful in future. But the idea here, and again, it's one that, although you wouldn't want to overstress the connections, but it's something we can see today, which is if the established political institutions don't seem to be dealing with the deep-rooted problems, and I think today we can say that the government doesn't seem to have a handle on the problems in the financial industry or in the wider economy, then if ordinary established institutions don't seem to be able to deal with these deep-rooted issues, then there is the risk of an outbreak of a more popular revolution from below.
That was Tony Moore of the University of Reading. Tony will be co-authoring a wider article on medieval finance that will appear in BBC History magazine in the next few months. You may well have views on what Tony said, so do get in touch to let us know what you think on email, podcast@historyextra.com, or one of our social media channels. That's about all for this week's episode. We'll be back next week when we'll be discussing the history of gas, among other things. In the meantime, please keep an eye on our website, historyextra.com, where you'll find blogs, features, quizzes, galleries, and more. And don't forget you can find our new Kindle and iPad editions on the Amazon website and the Apple newsstand, respectively. The History Extra Weekly podcast is recorded in Bristol and produced by Dave Gibson.